So now to this week's topic. I called it the legal interruptions in Bamidbar. So as I noted, Bamidbar is a bit of an interesting organizational structure. Right? It starts off, as we've done at this point extensively, with the census and the organization around the Mishkan. But then if you go, and then the role of the Levium, the census of the Levium, laws about the instructions of the Mishkan, and then Parshat Naso, if you open up, moves on to the responsibilities of each individual family, of Gershon, of Merari, etc., how you purify the camp. But then you suddenly get this interlude of laws, and you know, this is when our scroll is very helpful because you get all the little, you know, things on the side. But I also gave you the list, right? So if you look, this is from Ray Liebtag. It's a list of all of Sefer Bamidbar. On the left is the narrative components, and the right is the laws. So if you follow Bamidbar, so like as you go left to right on the chart, right, the story crisscrosses, right? It starts with organizing the camp, which is narrative. Then you get the laws of the Karban Chatat, right, the sin offering, and the laws of Sota Nazir, and the, right, so the adulterous wife, the Nazir, right, who devotes himself to not have wine and remain pure, and Birchat Kohanim, the blessing of the Kohanim, that's law. And then you go back to narrative, and you hear the dedication of the Mishkan, the appointing of the Levim, the offering of Karban Pesach in the desert, the laws of Pesach Sheni, traveling with the Anan, the gathering of the camp by the trumpet, leaving Har Sinai, the complaints, the Mizonim, and Tavim, right, the complaints for food and man and, you know, meat and all that, the complaints against Moshe, Korach, the Meraglim, and the punishment of wandering for 40 years, right? So you get this long narrative unit that takes you from the end of Naso through the end of Korach. And then you get, I put Korach in too early, Korach later, right? That brings you to the end of the Meraglim, rather, the end of the Meraglim story, right? Then you get the laws of Shlamim, right? And Challah, and Chatat, and Shabbos, and Tzitzis, right, which is sort of a random list in the middle. And then you get the rebellion of Korach, and then you get the laws relating to the Kohen's reward for his service, and then the laws of the Tumat Maid, of the impurities of someone who is dead. And then you go back to a narrative chunk, and you have but now you've skipped 38 years, right? All of that was the first 2 years, and then you skip 38 years, you're in the 40th year, and you hear about the death of Miriam, the complaining again at May Meriva for water, Moshe and Aaron hitting the rock, the death of Aaron, the conquest of the Transjordan, meaning on the east side, beating Sichon and Og. You get the long story of Bilam and Balak trying to curse the Jewish people, and then you get the sin of Baal Peor when the Jews slept with the Midianite women, the zealous act of Pinchas to kill Zimri and Cusbi, who engaged in this immorality. You get the census, again, before you enter the land of Israel. Then you get the transfer of leadership to Moshe and to Yoshua. Then you skip to some laws, and you do the Karban Tamid and Musafin, the laws of Nidarim. And then you go back to the narrative, and you get the war against Minyan, the inheritance of Reuven and Gad, and the summary of the journey through the desert. And then you end with some laws, preparing for conquest, inheritance of the laws, Nachlaut, Ari Miklat, right, the cities of refuge. And if you just look at Bamidbar, right, you get this. Yeah, the problem is, if you just look at the book, A, we crisscross randomly in terms of laws and narrative. But that's not really the biggest problem. Because, okay, we do that in other places in Tanakh, but Bamidbar is unique in a different way. And I gave you the summary here on the left side of one. Is that if we went through the other four books of Chumash, so Bereishis is almost exclusively narrative. Right? There are some laws, they're not clear that they're eternal laws. I mean, they are eventually eternal laws, but when law at all comes up, it's sort of accidental to the narrative. Like, Bereishis from beginning to end is narrative. The laws that come up at all are Pruvu, right? The mitzvah to procreate, which comes up in the story because God is trying to populate the world. So he tells people, you should procreate. The mitzvah of Bris Milah, which again is central to the story, right? That's Avram forging his covenant with God. It's there, but it's a narrative. And then the third is the Gid Hanasha, which clearly is narrative, right? Yaakov gets hit in his thigh, so we forbid the sciatic nerve, and we find out there's a mitzvah. That's the only legal component of Bereishis at all, and it's clearly that they're there because of the narrative. So Bereishis is a narrative work. If we skip to Vayikra, I'll come back to Shemot in a minute, Vayikra is almost entirely law, And the narratives that are there are to serve the law. So you think about the narratives. In Vayikra, it's the story of the inauguration of the Mishkan, right? Which is necessary to set up all the Karbanot. It's the story of the death of Nadav and Abihu, which is necessary to explain the dangers of misusing the Mishkan and then setting the laws for afterwards of not going to the Mishkan drunk and things like that. But Vayikra is almost exclusively law. Shmot is a mix, like Bamidbar, but Shmot, at least, the laws fit logically where they're supposed to be. Right, so if you go through, you think about Shmot, Shmot starts off with narrative, right? We're down in Egypt, and then the plagues start, and then we get freed. And then what laws do we get? Well, we get HaChodesh Hazeh Lachem, we get Rosh Chodesh, because God is beginning to give them a calendar and a holiday. Then he tells them about bringing the Korban Pesach. Now, in order to bring the Korban Pesach on the 10th day of the first month, well, I mean to separate it on the 10th day of the first month and bring it on the 14th, you need a calendar. So we needed HaChodesh Hazeh Lachem, and then we need the laws of the Korban Pesach. But that's because that's part of the story of the Geula, is that we brought the Korban Pesach. And then you have the... Right, then we go and we leave... once we leave Mitzrayim, so you go to Har Sinai, you hear Aseret HaDibrot. Well, of course you hear the Aseret HaDibrot. The story is God's revelation, the laws that came with it. And even Mishpatim, which is a huge legal section, it's, as the Torah tells you, the laws they got at Har Sinai. So the laws, it may be a law narrative mix, but they're in logical places, right? We went to Har Sinai, these are the laws we got at Har Sinai. We built the Mishkan, here are the laws of how to build the Mishkan. Dvarim is... it's not really either, right? I mean, it's law, but it's really a speech. So it's a bit different, right? It's a speech. Moshe is recording history. He's reminding them of what happened and reminding them of laws and teaching them new laws that they need before they go into Israel. But Bamidbar is really the outlier here, because Bamidbar, like Shmot, has a mix of laws and narrative, but the law and narrative don't seem to fit each other at all, right? It's not like Shmot, where we got to Har Sinai, so we get the Aseret HaDibrot. You find out the laws that were given in Har Sinai. Here, we were talking about organizing the camp, and then the Torah interrupts and says, by the way, here is the laws of Sota, right? Which is, right, here's the law of Nazir. Here's the blessing of the Kohanim, right? We're talking about... you know, you're talking about the transfer of leadership from Moshe Yeshua, and you hear about the Karban Tamid, right? The daily offerings, and you hear about the laws of vows. The law sections, it's not just that there is a mix of law and narrative, that's fine. It's that the law and narrative in Bamidbar don't seem to fit. So you look at Parshat Naso, you know, and you try to figure out, like, what is the rhyme or reason to this list of laws, and why are they mentioned here? And this really pushes us to, okay, well, right, what then is the function of these laws? What is the function of Bamidbar at all? So, if you look at 2, we started looking at this, but we didn't really analyze it. This is the Ramban's introduction to Bamidbar, where he explains what Bamidbar is, or isn't. So he says as follows: HaSefer hazeh kulo b'mitzvat sha'ah shin stavu bahem b'amdam b'amidbar. This book, being Bamidbar, deals entirely with, right, mitzvot sha'ah, meaning mitzvot, transient commandments, mitzvot of the time. So, like, some of these I understand, like the laws relating to the chatzotzrot, right, to the blowing of the trumpets. That is a law that fits the narrative, right? It's saying when this is how Moshe would use the trumpets when he would gather people together. So these laws that, right, so the book deals with mitzvot sha'ah that applied only during Bnei Israel's stay in the desert and the miracles that happened to them, to tell all the amazing things God did with them. It tells they began to give their enemies to them by the sword, instructed them as to how to divide the land. So he starts off by saying that Bamidbar, the mitzvah that are there, let's look at the next line. He says, the book does not contain any mitzvot l'darot, I mean, commandments for all generations. Stop there, right? We started off by, you know, a few weeks ago and saying, well, what is Bamidbar? Bamidbar is really the story of the Jews, how the Jews got from the Midbar, right, from Mitzrayim, got through the Midbar and got to Israel. So the Ramban says, well, that's the theory of Bamidbar, that it's the story of how the Jews make it to Eretz Israel. So the only thing I need to know are the stories that happen in the desert. I need to know the laws that were necessary during that time. But I don't need to know. It's not a legal book. It's not like Vayikra and Shemot or Devarim, which are telling you laws that are necessary forever. It's only telling you mitzvot shah. The problem is that doesn't fit the evidence. That's only true of most of Bamidbar. But some of Bamidbar does. So the Ramban says, right, now let's look at the Hebrew. He says, Ve'ein, the second line, Ve'ein b'sefer hazeh mitzvot nuhagot lidarot. In this book, there are no mitzvot forever. Zulati k'tzat mitzvot b'nyanei ha-karbanot she'etchil b'hen b'sefer ha-kohanim. Except for some mitzvot that we'd started talking about in Vayikra, v'lo nishlam sham, v'shliman b'sefer hazeh. And we didn't finish explaining them there, and they're finished here instead. Right? So the Ramban presents a really sort of weird theory, which is, yes, it doesn't fit. Right? Vayikra, Bereishis, makes sense. Shmos makes sense. Vayikra makes sense. Bamidbar doesn't make sense, because Bamidbar, the theme of Bamidbar, is how do we get through the desert? And therefore, the only thing we need to know are how we got through the desert, the stories that took us there, and the laws that we needed to know in the desert. But you know what? All those other laws that we're going to keep forever, you don't even need to know them. They're not part of the story. But we mentioned those that we had started talking about in Vayikra, and we never got around to finishing. Those we threw into Bamidbar randomly. Right? That's like the Ramban's theory at first glance, which is a really sort of strange theory of what Bamidbar is. So what we've got to do is really sort of try to analyze what is the Ramban really getting at, and what does it tell us about Bamidbar and the role of all of these laws that we have in the Sefer. So in 3 I just gave you, right, this will take us to the end, right, it's just sort of analyzing this, Rabbi Liebtag's assessment of this. So he starts off, he said, okay, well, let's just look at what they are. The mitzvot lisha'ah are commandments that were given specifically for the generation of the desert, such as organizing the camp around the Mishkan, right? So that technically is a mitzvah, right? The first 4 chapters of Bamidbar, how do you camp around the Mishkan, is a mitzvah, but it's a temporary mitzvah. That I understand why it's in Bamidbar. 2 is sanctifying the Levium. That's a one-time thing. The Levium becomes sanctified. Great. Traveling an encampment following the Anan, right? How exactly do you go through the desert? Makes sense. But then there are these mitzvot ledarot, right? Laws of sota, laws of nazir, laws of karbanot of tmidim usafin. So he says, according to the Ramban, Sefer Bamidbar details the events that take place during Bnei Israel's journey from Har Sinai towards the Promised Land. This includes both the narrative that details those mitzvot, those events rather, as well as the special mitzvot l'shah that Bnei Israel are given concerning that journey. The mitzvot lidorot, dealing with topics unrelated to the journey through the desert, do not belong in Sefer Bamidbar. So why does the Torah include mitzvot that don't belong in Sefer Bamidbar? And unfortunately, Ramban seems to have left this question unanswered. Right? This is the question that Ramban just leaves. Right? Then he pushes, and this is, again, an analysis of the Ramban. He says, and this is what the Ramban, you know, if we wanted to push Ramban's question even farther, it's not just that they don't seem to fit. You know, Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik, Professor Rabbi Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik, right? Well, there are many of those, but the older one, right? Soloveitchik, Yosef Dov Soloveitchik's son, Chaim, right? Rather than Rav Aaron Soloveitchik's son, Chaim, but whatever. He's pointed out, right? He said sometimes people will try to figure out in Rambam study, let's say, why does the Rambam organize certain laws in, you know, X book. So, for example, he says, why are the laws of Avelut in Sefer Shoftim? Right? The Rambam has 14 sections to his book. Why are the laws of mourning in the book that deals with judges? Right. So, he sets forth a very important methodological principle. And he said, that is only a good question if you have an answer to a different question, which is, well, do you have a better place to put it? Right, so he said, if you go through the 14 books of the Rambam, the first one talks about belief. Belief, okay, why would mourning be in belief? It doesn't belong there. Second one is ahava, it's tefillah and things like that. Okay, it doesn't belong in tefillah. Then zmanim, right, ones that talk about yomim tovim. That doesn't work, right? Nashim deals with marriage and the like. Nezikin deals with tort law, right? Zroim deals with agricultural law, Tarot deals with purity laws, Kachim deals with, right, the Karbanot, right? None of it fits. So he said, well, you can't give me a good answer to what book it should fit in. So what's normally the rule? If you don't know where to put something, where do you put it? At the end, right, as a coda. So he said, there's no good reason why you put Avelut in Shoftim necessarily, because it doesn't belong in the other 13. So if you have nowhere to put it, you put it in the 14th. Now, you could connect it and you could say, well, it goes after the laws of capital crimes, and they get buried, and there are certain exceptions in terms of mourning, but it's not really a good question, because unless you have a good place to put it, so why are you asking why you put it here? The problem is, you don't have that solution to our question. Because if you look at the laws that are in Bamidbar, as Rambam already noted, there is a ready-made answer to that question. Where should we have put the laws that seem not to fit in Bamidbar? Well, the Rambam told you. Vayikra, we started talking about them, and he continues, after a quick glance at the list in the right-hand column, right, that's what I gave you, the chart over here, right, the answer is quite obvious. They belong in Sefer Vayikra, right? That just makes the question worse, right? It's not just that they're here. There is a logical place, as the Rambam told you, to put them. So, for example, Parshat Sota and Parshat Nazir. Sota, how does it end? She brings a korban sota, a minchat kinaot. It could have gone in the list of the special minachot that we had in Parshat Vayikra and Sav. Right? There were lists there of the normal korbanot and then the exceptional korbanot, including sin offerings and unique sin offerings. Right? Asham gzelot, a korban you only bring for certain types of theft, yet you bring for breaking vows. There's a whole list of special korbanot in Vayikra. So sota could have gone there. It's a special mikdash-related thing. Nazir, he only gets out after a certain procedure of korbanot. He said both contain tarot, ritual procedure for korbanot. Thus, we explained in previous yerim, those parshiot belong to other tarot found in the first half of Vayikra. Then, para aduma. He said, para aduma, there is a really logical place for that. It's called Tazria Mitzora, which deals with purity laws. Right smack in the middle of Vayikra, we have a whole discussion of what if a person is pure, impure for X number of reasons? It's a good time to talk about, well, what if someone's impure because of death, and the only way out of it is Para Aduma? There's a logical place. It's called Tazria Mitzora. So Parshat Para Aduma belongs in Parshat Tazria Mitzora, together with the presentation of all the other laws of how one became Tameh, and the necessary procedures to become Tahor. The next one is even more obvious. The laws of Karbanot Tmidim U'Musafim. In Parshas Pinchas, you find out about the daily karbanot and the musaf offerings, right? Meaning the karbanot you only bring on Yom Tov. That was the theme of Parshat Emor. Parshat Emor goes through each holiday and the karbanot you bring on the holiday. So that belongs with the chagim in Emor. Note that in each holiday mentioned Emor, we must bring an isheh l'Hashem. And Sefer Bamidbar details the specific isheh that must be brought for each chag, right? So the Ramban's claim that, well, we only discussed laws that should have been Vayikra, that we didn't finish talking about them, just begs the question, why didn't you finish talking about them? Emor, this is like the most striking. Emor tells you, you will bring Karbanot on Yom Tov, and then you don't find out until Parshas Pinchas what those Karbanot are. But what could possibly justify not explaining yourself in Emor? Vayikra is the book about Karbanot. It tells you you need to bring these Karbanot, and then doesn't bother giving you the details for an entire Sefer, to almost the end of Sefer Bamidbar. All that, as Rabbi Liebknecht concludes, tells you, thus it appears as though Chumash has deliberately taken Parsha that could have been in Sefer Vayikra and randomly placed them in the narrative of Sefer Bamidbar. Right? The conclusion you almost get is, it wasn't random. It was an intentional that we left things over from Vayikra and threw them in Bamidbar. And, you know, if you look, it's almost in order. It's basically in order, right? The beginning of Vayikra starts with discussions of personal karbanot. Sota and Nazir are the beginning of Bamidbar. In the middle of Sefer Bamidbar is Tazria Mitzora, which deals with purity laws, and Para Aduma is smack in the middle of Bamidbar. And towards the end of Vayikra, you get the holiday laws, and that's where you get the laws of the holiday Karbanot in Bamidbar. So it sounds like, not just it was intentional, the Torah is somehow, right, it's like lining up Vayikra and Bamidbar, and then sort of You know, it's you know, it's like you have a spreadsheet, right, and you accidentally merge, right? So it'll be more or less at the same place in the column, just in the wrong column, right? It almost as if the Torah intentionally merged Bamidbar and Vayikra, right? And just sort of, so the laws are basically parallel, not in any logical order. They're just about where they should be in Vayikra, just in Bamidbar, right? It's just, when you think about it, it is so random as if to force you to believe that the Torah did this on purpose. So, why would you do this? So this is coming back to something that we've talked about a lot, both in Shemot and Vayikra, and now in Bamidbar, which is, and I'll set it out and then we'll go through it in detail, that, remember the double ending, how we started the double ending of Shemot? Right, the Shemot ends and opens up both Vayikra and Bamidbar, right? That God's presence descended onto the camp and into the Ol Moed, right? So the last few Pesukim of Shemot tell you that God interacts with the Jewish people in two ways. One is in the camp, and one is in the Mishkan. But those are really part of the same story, which is, how does God, once his presence descended in Shemot, how does he interact with the Jewish people? And those are really two simultaneous stories that got siphoned out into two books. Vayikra tells the story, or the laws, but gives you the picture of what it means for God to interact with the Jewish people in the confines of the Mishkan. Though, as we noted last year when we did Vayikra, not exclusively. Vayikra itself starts with Mikdash laws, but then goes to Kashrut and things that relate to everyday life. But Vayikra primarily still focuses on God's relationship with the Jewish people in the Mishkan. But Midbar is about how do we walk with God in the Midbar. But if, let's say, we had made a perfect division, and we put all Karbanot laws in Vayikra, and all travel stories in Bamidbar, what would that imply? That would imply that these are two stories, right? That you can be the Mikdash Jew, you can be the ritual Jew, the monk in the monastery, or you can be the Jew out there doing chesed and being in the real world and you know, having a job and being the Kadesh Shem Shemaim in everyday life and traveling. And that those are two different paths of Avodat Hashem. But the point is, no, Vayikra and Bamidbar are just presenting two types of approaches, but they actually need to be intertwined. So how do you make the point that they're really one story? You literally take laws, you take part from one, right? It's like, you know, it's like in a camera, right? How do you, you know, it's like in a movie, right? In a movie, sometimes you'll have two storylines that will eventually intersect, but you don't know how they're going to intersect. But in order to make it clear to the audience they're going to intersect, right, instead of showing you story one and two and then only showing you at the end how they come together, the camera goes back and forth, right? This is his life story. This is her life story, right? And look, right, he got kicked out of school, so he went back to live with his parents in New York. And look, she got a job in New York. And you already know in advance that that means, right, if it's listed as a, you know, romantic comedy, that they will, something is going to happen eventually, and they're going to meet in New York, right? But how does the director or the producer make you know, right, tip you off to the fact that this is going to be a love story about people meeting in New York by showing you in scenes as you move through? But Vayikra and Bamidbar are basically that, right? Where Vayikra is mostly the story of how does God interact in the Mishkan. Bamidbar is mostly the story of how does God interact in our daily lives and traveling and the mundane things. But if you separated them, you'd think they're two stories. So instead of doing that, we just borrow a few details and we, right, move the camera as if you're going back to Vayikra, right? And in Vayikra we did the same thing. We had certain things that talked about the camp, right? Like Kashrut, right? Kashrut isn't really about, it's related to Karbanot, right? It's about food, you know, kosher animals, which is related to Mishkan, but it's really about camp life. It's about normal life. So in each book, we put laws that are really from the other book to make it clear that these are meant to be two intertwined stories, and it's almost random. Now, it's not totally random, but the real point is to emphasize the connection between the two books rather than you know, give you a coherent direct story. So then he continues, right? Shechina of the camp. The first topic, and now let's think, with that in mind, let's go back to the law. So he said, okay, the first topic of Sefer Bamidbar is the organization of the camp surrounding the Mishkan. As we've explained last week, this reorganization of the camp stresses the importance of the interdependent relationship between the camp and the Mishkan, i.e., between the nation and the Kohanim and the Levim. Now this may explain the reason Sefer Bamidbar chose to include the parshiot that follow. Shiluach Tmeim. So, sure, this is a law which belongs in Vayikra. It's about purity. But which purity law gets put in Bamidbar? Shiluach Tmeim, right? Which people who are impure, where in the camp do they have to live? Which camp do they get kicked out of? Right? In Vayikra, you find out most of the purity laws, but the aspect of it that some people who are impure can't be in certain parts of the camp, that's a Bamidbar. Right? That's a Vayikra law that actually makes sense in Bamidbar. Right? It's, you know what? Purity laws may be primarily about the Mikdash, but it also has effect in your daily life, in the camp life. Because some people are only kicked out of Machane Shechinah. They can't go into the Mikdash and the Mishkan. But some people are kicked out of Machane Leviyah and Machane Yisrael also. Meaning, purity laws do affect life. So Shiluach Tmeim, the camp was organized with the Shechinah dwelling in its center, the first mitzvah is to remove anyone who's tamei from the camp. The next law is Gezel Hager. Right? If you steal from a ger who doesn't have any relatives, right? So there's, you can't really return it to him, so instead there's a special korban. So here we find the laws that reflect the special relationship between the nation and the Kohanim. This mitzvah brings with the standard law of the korban Hashem, as explained in Sefer, in Parshat Vayikra. The halacha requires that prior to bringing the korban, the transgressor must first repay the person, Ker Vachomesh. This parsha describes the case when the payment is given to the Kohen, when the person who's owed the money has passed away and left no inheritors. So Gezel Ager, right, if someone steals from a ger, indifferent to the Karban Asham that it was, you know, that was discussed in certain cases in Vayikra, if someone steals from a ger and has to pay back the ger, but the ger dies with no relatives, you pay it to the Kohanim. But that's not really a Kohen law. There are certain interpersonal laws that if you don't have a way of paying it back, so, right, you can't fix it on the interpersonal level, so we allow you to fix it by giving to the Kohen. Again, that's a Vayikra law, but it sheds light on Bamidbar, that, you know, sometimes you violate an interpersonal law, and you can't fix it on the interpersonal level, because there's no ger to return it to, but you could give it to the Kohen, and that'll act as some sort of atonement. It's a Mikdash law, but it's a Mikdash law through the lens of Bamidbar. Right? It's a Mikdash law through the lens of sometimes interpersonal laws can be fixed, or interpersonal crimes can be fixed in the Mikdash. Right? The parasha continues with the general statement regarding the legal ownership of tithes that the nation must give to the Kohanim. Parshat Sota. Again, here we find a special relation between the Kohanim as servants in the Mishkan and the nation, as the Kohen is instrumental in solving problems in a marital relationship. I mean, Sota may be, in the end of the day, a story of a Mikdash, but why is the Sota thing exist? Because the husband's jealous, and his wife, in the case of a Sota who is innocent, right, she's, right, their relationship is going to be destroyed because he thinks she's committing adultery, and maybe she isn't. The Mikdash is used to solve the marital problem. Right, so it's, again, Vayikra through the lens of Bamidbar. It's the Mikdash coming to tell you that the Torah cares about your marriages. Right, so it's, yes, it's sort of random, but it's not actually random, it actually makes sense. Right, this parsha describes the case when there, I'm sorry, it went back. Even though this is a Korban Mincha, its nature is quite different from those mentioned in Vayikra. Nazir. Nazir, again, ends with Karbanot. But what is really Nazir? Nazir is, Vayikra is that certain people are Kohanim, and they have to be holy. Nazir is, if you want to, you can also be like a Kohen. And you can accept the purity laws of the Kohen Gadol to not become Tamei no matter what. But again, that's Vayikra through the lens of Bamidbar. It's sanctity laws which your average person could accept. They could make themselves a Kohen if they wanted to without being a Kohen. The Nazir is what Kahuna looked like for non-officers of the Mikdash, right? Here we find a case where a member of the nation takes upon himself laws similar to those of the Kohen as well as the Kedusha of a Kohen. Note also the similarity between the Kohen and the Nazir must bring, between the Karban and the Nazir must bring, and the special Karbanot brought by the Kohanim during the 7-day Miluim, right? They bring very similar Karbanot. Birchat Kohanim. Again, it's a Kohen law. But what type of Kohen law? It's the Kohen blessing the people. It's the Kohen interacting with the average Jew in the camp. And the blessing of the Kohanim bestow on the nation is yet another example of this connection between the Kohanim and the Machaneh. The Kohanim serve as a vehicle through which God can bless his people. So traveling with Shchina. So why are specifically parshut from Sefer Yikra to Sefer Midbar? The structure of Midbar reflect a way of life, etc., etc., etc. And so I think, right, if you look especially in Naso, why is it that Bamidbar is, as the Ramban said, right, a book primarily of narrative and temporary laws, because the main thrust of the book is how do the Jews get from Mitzrayim and get to Eretz Yisrael? That's the story. And laws that, temporary laws, how did they function in the Mishkan, in the Midbar? That's really relevant. But if you, but then the Ramban tells you that there are laws from Vayikra that got left over and thrown by Midbar. Why would you throw over extra laws? There's a good place for it. And the answer seems to be twofold. One is, we don't want to separate Vayikra and Bamidbar as if they're two different stories. Because if you separate them completely, you think that there's two ways of being a Jew. One is being the officer of in the Mishkan, in the Mikdash, and the other is being a Jew living your normal life. No, that's not how it is. Yes, God is with you both in the confines of the Mishkan and in the camp and in your everyday life. But those aren't two different stories. That's one story that God wants to interact with humanity. And there are different ways that he does that. And both of them are part of the full story. So yes, we sort of, as Ramban said, it's basically leftovers, right? We specifically leave things over to remind you that these two ways of relating to God are interconnected. But then you look a little bit closer and you realize it's not totally random. It's not like we just took any laws. We took laws that while they are Vayikra-esque, they're Vayikra-esque through the lens of Bamidbar. They are the ones that specifically show you that the Mishkan has implications outside the confines of the Mishkan itself. Again, Gezel Ager tells you that sometimes the way to fix interpersonal relationships is through relationship with God, through the Kohanim. Birchat Kohanim tells you that the role of the Kohanim, even the priest in the Mishkan, is not only in the Mishkan, but they also are the conduits to bless the Jews who are out in the camp. Sota tells you, yes, it's a karban in the Mikdash, but it's there to tell you that God cares about marriages. Nazir, yes, the Nazir is like a Kohen, but he's not a Kohen. It's telling you that the average person, if he wanted to, could be like a Kohen, could choose to live that life. Shiluach Tmeim, yes, it's purity laws, but he's not only kilked out of the Shechina, because not only is Machane Shechina or the Mishkan is holy, but the whole camp where the Jews live is also holy, and therefore, even the average part of the camp, your average home, some people, if they're impure, have to be kicked out, because there's a level of sanctity in your everyday life. And so Bamidbar borrows laws from Vayikra, but specifically those laws that highlight the Bamidbar side of the equation, the notion that God is present in the camp and present in everyday life and cares about everyday life. So that seems to be why you have these, what I call legal interruptions, right? Because yes, when you follow the narrative, they actually do break up the narrative, right? I don't have a magic solution for why they don't break up the narrative. They do break up the narrative. But that's the point. It's supposed to be jarring. It's supposed to make you think and say, hey, this is out of place, so why is it here? Right? Well, if it's not here because it aids the narrative, it's not like Shmot. Shmot, the laws aid the narrative. Here they distinctly do not. But it's specifically because they're so jarring that they force you to ask the question, well, then God, why does God put them here? To remind you that the stories of Vayikra and Bamidbar are actually related. They're actually interconnected. God's relationship with humanity in both of its manifestations are intimately connected. So that brings us really through Naso, because I don't want to sort of get into the nitty-gritty of all the laws in Naso, but that should sort of give a snapshot of what types of laws Bamidbar is presenting and what they give us for the general perspective, both on Chumash and Sefer Bamidbar specifically.